I think Whitley Strieber knows a little bit about what that's like. We mentioned earlier about the success of the book Communion. He and his wife received something like 500,000 letters in response to Communion. And then who knows how many letters and emails and things of that sort in response to the books that he's written since Communion. You know, we're talking about the kind of the crossroads of religion and UAPs involving ghosts, or rather the continuation of human consciousness after death, and other really strange topics, seemingly strange. And these are treacherous waters, kind of thin ice, both for religious scholars and for paranormal investigators and writers. I mean, no one is quite comfortable with mixing them all into one hat or under one umbrella. No one except maybe Whitley Strieber and his pal Jeffrey Kripal, and a colleague of theirs, Dr. Diana Pasulka. Her book, American Cosmic, a couple of years ago, was a huge surprise hit when it came out. She was also a witness to one of the strange events involving Whitley and his departed or not so departed wife, Anne. We're going to take a call from Professor Pasulka in this next segment, hear part of her story. And then with Whitley, we're going to dig into some of the individual experiences he's been reporting in his new book, A New World. We'll be right back. Whitley, I had mentioned about the 500,000 or so letters that Communion sort of generated from people all over the world. I'm sure the number is much bigger than that now. And you and Anne tried to read as many as you could and get information out of them. And I imagine a lot of people were looking to you for answers. Please explain what this is, what it means, why me, that kind of stuff. When you were struggling then and still to some degree now, trying to figure out yourself what it means, who they are, why they're here, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, in the context of the day, it's the alien abduction scenario. That was the paradigm at the time. You see that figure on the cover. At the same time, you know, Bud Hopkins' books and David Jacobs had been writing about it, and then later Dr. John Mack. And the prism through which people interpreted that is alien abductions, aliens from other planets here to snatch us up and probe us and do who knows what inside their spaceships. But your view of that has changed so much since then, right?
It's changed tremendously. I think I can best sum up the change with a story that actually goes back quite a few years. This happened while, not long after Communion was published, I don't think. I received a call from my agent, and this was before the internet, so it wasn't so easy for people to get a hold of you in New York, saying that there was a man who desperately needed to get a hold of me. He had something he needed to talk to me about. And this was fairly extraordinary because finding my agent took some doing. And so I said to the agent, "Give me his number and I will call him." And I called him, and he turned out to be someone connected with the airline industry. And he had this story to tell. Lived in somewhere in the South. And this is the story. He said, "A few nights ago, my wife and I were in the living room. Our dog was asleep on the hearth. He had been out and he was going to be there for the night when suddenly he became incredibly nervous and woke up. And my wife decided to take him out again, which was unheard of. But she took him out, and as she opened the front door, a ball of light raced across the sky and disappeared behind the trees." They lived in the woods, in a woody area. And she turned around and called back into the house saying, "Honey, I just saw a plane go in on fire. You're going to get a call in a minute," because in his job, he would have been called if there was a crash. At that moment, their 7-year-old came running down the stairs saying, "Mommy, Daddy, little blue men brought Jimmy," his older brother, "into my room, and he said to tell you he was okay." And what had happened was the man was desperate to to talk to me because their older boy had been killed a week before in a car crash. And he said to me, if there's any way I can believe this, I thought you would be the one to ask. And I said to him, and I could say this truthfully, yeah, the dead are definitely connected with this in some way, so I'm not too surprised. Now, I'm going to circle back to another story. Annie, when we were starting to get these letters in huge masses and boxes of them, decided she needed a secretary. And I said, well, I'll call Manpower. And she said, no, I'll find one in the letters. I thought, well, that's crazy. Then a few seconds later, I mean, Annie knew, Annie orchestrated this whole thing. I mean, if you talked to Jeffrey long enough, he would have probably said that she was connected somehow to the visitors. But anyway, a few minutes later, she says, okay, here's our secretary. And I look at this letter, and it's from a singer. And a lady says she's a singer and an actress. I said, well, she's a singer. And she said, look at the handwriting. That's the handwriting of a professional. I said, but she's not a secretary. She said, look, have you ever heard of her? I said, no. Then she's definitely got a job, and it's going to be as a secretary. I'll call her right away. It turned out she lived around the corner, and she ended up being Ann's secretary for 15 years. Her name was Lori Barnes, and the reason she had written the letter was that back in the 50s, she had been lying in bed at night at about 11 o'clock, and her husband was out on a gig, and she was pregnant. And she'd looked up. She'd noticed movement out of the corner of her eye. She's reading, and she looked up, and there were these dark, short, dark blue figures standing in a line beside the bed. And she was absolutely horrified. And the leader said, do not be afraid. We're not here for you. We're here. We're interested in the girl child you're carrying. Helped. I mean, you know, she said, I'm not afraid anymore. Not exactly. She continued to recoil, and then he said, why are you so frightened? And she said, because you're so ugly. And he put his dark blue gloved hand on her hand and said, my dear, one day you will look just like us. You know what I think I have just told you a story about? Two stories put together? I think some of these figures are human beings in another form. If you look at a caterpillar, would you ever guess it became a butterfly?
No.
I don't think nature is full of multi-form species, and we may be one of them. Isn't that remarkable?
It is.
Yeah.
You know, one of your friends, colleagues, who has traveled down this road, this same kind of roads where people can talk about religion, dead people, aliens, all mixed into the same bowl, is Dr. Diana Pasulka, who is the She's at the North Carolina Wilmington, chairman of the Department of Philosophy and Religion. She wrote a book called American Cosmic in 2019. She was my guest on this program, and she has her own personal take on one of the weird things that happened in proximity to you, Whitley. And Diana is on the phone, surprise guest. Hey, Diana, how you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks for staying up late.
I was up late, and
okay.
I'm happy to be here. Yeah, talk to Whitley. Whitley's a good friend.
That's for sure.
What's your story? What's the story that you were personally involved in or witnessed?
So this was with somebody in my book, Tyler, and we were at a conference that Whitley was at. And so Tyler had never met Whitley, nor did he know, really, he never read Communion. And nor did he know anything about Whitley. And Tyler is a person who is in the space industry, works in the space industry. So we were at a conference that was discussing the topic of UFOs, and we were a mix of humanities professors and people who did the scientific study of the phenomena. And so we had our own rooms, unlike Esalen, where Dr. Kripal has his, you know, does his thing. But Dr. Kripal was there, and he and I were co-organizing the event. So my job was to organize the event in the morning. And what happened was that I woke up early. I went to the place where we would all meet. There were about 15 scholars there, one of whom worked with me, Dr. Patty Teresi. She's a philosopher. And again, she knew who Whitley was, but she had never met him. And so I got there and I saw Whitley talking to Jeff, and they were having a conversation in which I could tell it was somewhat strange. I could tell that Whitley was trying to explain something to Jeff, and Jeff didn't quite understand. And at the same time, I was receiving a text message from Tyler telling me that he couldn't come to the conference that day in the morning because Whitley had appeared in his room. And now you have to understand that this was fairly early on in my research. So I was, again, I wasn't necessarily a hardcore believer. So I thought, well, this is strange. And I said, what do you mean Whitley appeared in your room? I thought maybe Whitley like walked down the hallway and maybe knocked on his door or something and wanted to talk philosophy with Tyler about space or something. And he said, no. Whitley appeared in my room and I have to sleep. So I said, okay, no problem, don't come. And so then I had no idea what Whitley was going to say, but Whitley said, I have an announcement to make to the group. And he said, I appeared in somebody's room. And he goes, and I don't know whose room it was. I thought it was Jeff's room, but he was asleep. So that's funny because Jeff did say that he was sleeping well the whole night. And then he went to another person's room, and that person was having a bad night's sleep. And in fact, my colleague, Patty, told me that she was having a bad night's sleep, and so she would be late. And he said he finally ended up in another person's room. And Whitley, I don't know if you, did you know that was Tyler's room?
Yes, I did. And I had, as soon as I got into the room, it was clear that there was a message for him. And this is the third time in my life that I have showed up in somebody's proximity in an out-of-the-body state, and they've been able to see me. So, since it's happened twice before, I was fairly comfortable with it. And I delivered the message, which is personal, and I didn't know I had the message until I was in the room, but I suppose that was always the reason that I was out, because what happens when I get out, I don't leave my body on my own. I've never been able to do that. I knew Bob Monroe of the Monroe Institute, and he gave me all kinds of pointers, and I had a gateway with him at his wonderful place. It's still very much alive and very open, Monroe Institute, but I just couldn't do it myself. However, the visitors can do it to me. And what had happened that night was that I did my usual meditation at 3, and it's pretty hard to do because I'm tired, you know, after the day of a conference. I went back to sleep, and at 4, they woke me up again by sending an electric shock down my spine. And I thought, damn, why didn't you? I did this at 3. Now you're after me again in this miserably uncomfortable little room with a horrible chair. But I got up and I started to meditate. And I start. No, I'm just too sleepy. They're going to have to wait till tomorrow. This is ridiculous. And I lay down in the bed. And the next thing I knew, I was out in the hall. And I thought, oh, Lord, you fool. You went out in the hall and closed the door. And it's in the middle of the night, and the door has a self-lock on it. What are you going to do? You're going to have to sleep in the hall all night now. And so the next thing I realized, I'm gliding. And I thought, holy moly, I'm out of my body. How cool is this? And immediately I thought, I want to wake Jeff up, because Jeff would love to see this, if he can see me. I wasn't sure he would be able to. I went into his room, and he might as well have been laid out. I mean, that guy was totally asleep. And you find out very quickly when you do this, you can't do anything. And like Anne says now, when she was living in this state, she says, it looks like everybody is intentionally ignoring us. And that's how the dead see us, I think. And that's certainly how you see it when you're out of the body. Anyway, so I went down the hall, and I guess I must have gone into Patty's room, and she was there. But, I've had an experience with doing this to a woman, and I didn't think I would manifest in her room because she might get rather upset in the middle of the night. So I went to the next room, and I recognized Tyler. I didn't know him very well at all. And then all of a sudden, this message came out of my mouth. And the next thing I knew, I shot up in through the ceiling. And he did say he saw me leave through the ceiling, which is, there's few people who've seen that. That's like, he's not the only one. Anyway, I went way to Dickens up, higher than I can ever remember going in that out-of-body state. And I could see, we were in Petaluma, California, and I could see the Pacific. I was so high that I could actually see the line of dawn in the middle of the continent. It was just awesomely beautiful and quite scary because, you know, you think to yourself, you know, I mean, I'm still feeling like a physical being, and yet I'm here, and I, you know, I'm thinking about falling, frankly. The next thing I knew, I went shooting down into the dawn and ended up on a street in what was obviously a college campus. And I went into a dormitory. I moved around in the campus and tried to get a young man who was walking on the street to notice me. It was early in the morning, on a Sunday morning. He didn't notice me. So I went into a dormitory to see if I could find anyone who I could get to notice me. And it is because I knew there would be people in the dormitories. I assumed all the classrooms would be closed and empty. And I went into the first room I found. And I couldn't, there was a man in there lying on the bed, but I could not wake him up. And I began to get nervous. I think, you know, I'm awfully far from my body. I don't want to end up, it'd be really idiotic to end up, my body dies while I'm out here rummaging around in somebody's dorm room. Then I go back and I have no place to live anymore. So I went, as soon as I thought that, I just went out and just grandly, beautifully rose up into the sky and shot back to my body in an instant. And then, do you remember the rest of the story when I came to the campus?
Diana,
absolutely. Yes.
Tell that part of it, why don't you?
We're going to a break in about a minute, so
okay.
Just let you know.
Okay. So the thing is, you have to understand that this was in the midst of my writing my book, and I was still very atheistic about the whole thing. And I would not have believed any of this, George, had I not seen it for myself. So I got the text from Tyler while Whitley was telling Jess that something had happened and that he had gone into Tyler's room. And I'm getting this text from Tyler, and I'm thinking, what is going on? And so by the time lunch happened, several of us were going, we were going to a rock.
I'll tell you what, that music is telling us we have to go to a break. Diana, if you want to hold on, we'll let you finish the story on the other side of this. All right. We're talking about Diana Pasulka and Whitley Strieber, of course. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Are we on the verge of something big? Is something amazing about to begin? Whitley Strieber thinks so. We're going to ask him to explain what he thinks is coming, and we'll also finish up the story with Diana Pasulka about what she witnessed, the strange series of events that she witnessed, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Diana Pasulka, so you are there. Whitley is explaining this series of events to Jeff, and you are receiving a message from Tyler. But there has been no communication between Whitley and Tyler that would have explained this other than in a really strange series that you've just described, right?
Yes, yes. So I basically didn't believe at that point. I was writing a book from an academic perspective, but I was completely atheistic. And so here I was, I had two credible witnesses, did not know Whitley, confirming what Whitley had done. And then what happened was we went into a car ride for an outing at lunch, and every single person who chose to, I drove, every person who drove in that vehicle, and there were about five of us, had something happen to them that night with Whitley. And they all confirmed it in the car. And all of us, I think there was a message for everyone. Whitley says he gave a message to Tyler. I have no doubt about it, because Tyler was really freaked out. And I think the message for me was that this happens and it's real. And in fact, the university that Whitley saw was basically my university, the university where Dr. Teresi and I work. And we identified, Whitley told us what he saw, and we brought it up on, you know, our phones, and we showed it to him. We said, is this it? And he said, yes, that's it. So about a couple months later, we had Whitley out to our university. He identified the dormitory, and he went into it, and he found the room in which he had gone. So it was a very weird experience for everyone, confirmed by things that, I was an outsider writing purely academically, not a believer. And after that, everything changed. So, yes, that's the story. And
well, it occurs to me maybe this happened for your benefit, that you were the intended recipient of this information as you're working on American Cosmic.
I talked to Whitley about that. And I said, you know, Whitley, I think there were several intended recipients, and that's what he said, right, Whitley? Remember you?
Yeah, because I think that was, you know, you were all gathered together at that conference, and there was a chance from some level to maybe open a door for you, because you're out here doing this now, and in his own work, it has affected Tyler profoundly, and in many ways, and others as well, and me, because I'll never forget the moment when I went into that dormitory physically, and I realized that, because I had Patty Teresi and Diana, I had described it all very carefully to them, and they figured out where it was. And so when I went to the campus, I went into that dormitory and saw for the first time physically a place I had seen before in the non-physical and never prior to that. It was a really awesome experience for all of us. And it just tells you, one thing it tells you is that not only do we have souls, but they can be right here. And they can be seen, but not necessarily. And you think to yourself, well, you know, Jeff was talking earlier about the fact that the dead sometimes perhaps can walk among us physically and we don't know it. But I think this is the world of the dead in a sense. I think that they're right here. And I'm just so haunted by Annie saying what I mentioned a few minutes ago, Annie saying, it looks like you're all intentionally ignoring us. It's amazing.
Diana, thank you very much for joining the conversation. And I hope you're working on something cool. And I hope if you are working on something cool that you'll let us know about it and come back.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, George. And thank you, Whitley. Great.
Oh, thank you for coming, Diana. It was wonderful.
Whitley, in this in the book, A New World, you get down to the nitty-gritty in terms of sharing with us. You've always been sort of vague about the visitors, why they're here and where they're from, understandably, because you didn't really have any solid answers. But you have something closer to solid answers now, because the communication and the encounters have continued right up to this present day.
Oh, yeah. They're part of my life now. I'm in this. And after Annie passed away, a few weeks later, I started to get, the first thing that happened that led to my present relationship with the dead and the visitors was that I went to a conference, again, I mentioned William Henry and Claire Henry earlier in the show, that they had in Nashville, And at the conference, a lady came up to me, very perplexed looking, and said, "Mr. Streber," she had been at some of our Dreamland festivals. I had my podcast, Dreamland. We used to have festivals there in Nashville. And so I said to her, she said to me, she knew Ann's voice, in other words. She said to me, "I just heard Ann say something to me very clearly. She said, 'Tell Whitley I can see him when he's sitting in the chair.'" And this had tremendous significance for me, because there is a place in my living room where I sit every night and meditate. And I've been doing this meditation called the sensing exercise, which you can find out more about on Unknown Country. I don't want to go into it. It's a simple exercise of basically placing the attention on the body. And it doesn't seem like much, but it's a huge thing, actually. So I immediately understood that she could perceive me when I was doing the exercise. And then the next thing I knew, I came back here to the apartment, and I started to be waked up at 3 o'clock in the morning as well to do the exercise. And I didn't know why for years. But then I found out that it's a time of day which in certain traditions in yoga is called Brahma Muhurta time. And it's the time when you're open to inner change. And so I've been doing this. I'm very deeply involved at this point with them and with Annie. And basically, it's just absolutely wonderful. It's gone from being a holy terror at first back in 1985 to what it is now, which is the most rich, productive, wonderfully creative experience of my life. And right now I'm writing a book on Jesus, which is a completely new vision of Jesus that is very much coming out of my world as it is now in my relationships. And it is a perfectly beautiful experience. There's nothing dark or sinister or evil about it at all. Not at all.
And in the book, you explore a variety of different ideas about where they could be from. It's not, you don't pick a specific one. You're not locking into one possible answer. It could be multiple answers. And,
well, I think it has to be multiple answers. I think that's why we're so confused about it, because actually everything is true. So naturally we're trying to figure out, well, they must be from here, they must be from there. But no, this theory doesn't work if they're from here. But then if they're from there, this theory doesn't work. So what's going on? And we're very confused. But I think we're in touch with our own dead in a new way. And as I said before, the human species itself may have more than one form, and we are in touch with us and one other form and our dead. And I think we're probably in touch with visitors from this universe. But I think that they have also got the capability of being in mirror universes. And also, there's no barrier for them between the living and the dead. Not at all. So what's going to happen to us is that if we can bring this all into focus, this new world, which is going to be basically a completely new understanding of what we are and where we are in the world and what our potentials are and what the next level of the human adventure is going to be, is just going to explode into reality, hopefully, sometime. And I think that the more pressure we're under, as the environment disintegrates and these migrations are starting all over the world, and they're resulting in all kinds of political pressure because, you know, there's nationalistic Poland and places all over in the United States, and all of these countries that feel threatened by immigration are becoming very nationalistic, and there's people's, you know, it's just an upheaval on the way, let me put it that way. So I think that's all happening. And I think in the context of all that pressure, we might make a huge breakthrough into a new way of thinking. That's what I'm hoping will happen.
And part of it is they want to accelerate the pace, pick up the pace. You were under some pressure to write this and get the word out, so, right?
Super pressure. Oh, God. I've never been pressured by them before, but believe me, I've pissed them off any number of times in my life. And, you know, it can be a little scary, but you definitely don't want to be under pressure from them because they don't understand missing deadlines. At least whatever it was that was involved with me in writing this book did not understand that. And I often worked through 24-hour days on that book. It was intense. It was very intense. And, you know, they were literally right there. There's a house I go to in Texas that I've been going to since I was a little boy, and I've had lots of experiences there over the years. And when I would go to that house, they would be there, and they didn't show themselves except once or twice, and it's extremely intense for people who are not used to it when they show themselves, like what happened to Jeffrey and at Esalen, and they showed themselves to a lady there, an elderly woman, who she said to me that it happened. I was awake when it happened, and I heard it happen, and she was awake when it happened too. And I went upstairs because she was in bed, and I was downstairs reading, and I said, "Are you all right?" And she said, "Yeah, I'm fine." But I thought she might not be so fine, and because the pressure is intense. And the next afternoon, she started to have a heart attack. And I got a doctor friend who lives nearby to come over, and he got her into the hospital and got her a pacemaker, and she's fine. But it's going to be hard. It's real hard. I can tell you why, so people understand this. We are inside the stream of time. This is where we belong. We're like, visualize us as fish in a stream. And these other entities, whatever they are not in there with us, in here with us, most of them. They're outside the stream, and they see time from the outside. And that's not where we belong. And when they get near us, it's exactly like a fish being pulled out of the stream. The world suddenly stops making sense, and it's absolutely terrifying. That was the fear that Jeff experienced, and a lot of people experienced that. I experienced for years, but I got used to it because I've been out of that stream a number of times, and you're actually fine. It's just a little disorienting at first. So that's kind of where I am with this right now, and I'm doing it as best I can, and they're right. I mean, we are obviously in big trouble. I mean, this pandemic is way out of hand. And I mean, it's nobody's fault. Everybody's pointing the fingers at everybody else. But no one knew how to handle this when it came along first. And we're under a lot of pressure. And the more that pressure builds, the more likelihood is that there's going to be real change.
Real change from them, our relationship with them, but also real change for us. I mean,
exactly. Exactly.
I want to get into Skinwalker Ranch because that's, you know, the paradigm that I was working in when I started down this road was about aliens, space aliens, ETs visiting from other planets. And that was sort of the paradigm. When you wrote Communion, aliens is sort of a placeholder of a name that I think people use in government who are studying this stuff too, just thinking of them as ETs, even though nobody really knows. And now you've pretty much changed. I mean, they could be space aliens. What they're able to do, they could be from far, far away and they're here, or they can be right next to us and they're here.
I think some of them probably are, because this is such a huge universe, and if there's anybody who can get around, and there has to be. I mean, just statistically, if it's possible, If it's impossible, then no. But if it is possible, and I think it probably is on a lot of different levels, then some of them are from this universe and from other parts of it. But not all by any means. That might be quite a small part of it. But let's talk more about the Skinwalker Ranch, because I've got some thoughts about that too. I've often wondered what would have happened if I'd gone there. Maybe it's better I don't find out.
Well, I mean, it's still there. And, you know, it's the whole area of the Uinta Basin has been a hot spot for UFO activity. But you look a little bit further beneath the surface, and there's so much more. And the ranch, Bigelow bought the ranch in 96 and owned it for 20 years. It has a new owner, Brandon Fugel, now. But, you know, pretty much everyone who goes there, except for me, has had experiences that range from disembodied voices, UFOs of all shapes and sizes, poltergeist, trickster-type activity where things move around and disappear, funny little events, specters, misty creatures that float through walls, animal mutilations of all kinds, crypto creatures that appear, holes in the sky in which different kinds of floating objects, flying objects, come in and out, almost as if they're going to another world on the other side. The sky looks different. So it's a whole big mix of every kind of imaginable paranormal, supernatural activity all in one place. And it's totally unpredictable. Nothing ever happens quite the same. You set up cameras, you can't record it. There's very little in the way of physical evidence, but it's been there a long time. And it struck us as maybe it's some kind of a learning curve. It wants us to figure out that reality is far more complicated than we've ever imagined before. Nobody's quite cracked who they are or what intelligence it is that's present there, but it's made itself abundantly clear, but still elusive and hard to prove. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to get your thoughts on how that fits into your scenario and then share with the audience that you've figured out what these visitors, what their interest is in us, what they get out of us. And I want to get into that right after this on Coast to Coast, and also open up the phone lines in the next hour. On behalf of the whole world, welcome back, baseball. Please save us.